Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, how's it going for you today? Personally, I've had a hard time getting going this week. If you've been following these podcasts for the last couple of months, you'll probably remember that sometime in June I started whining about how much work it was taking to get ready for Burning Man. And then, after I got back, I complained that I was out of energy and had to recover from Burning Man. Well, now it's October, and I seem to have run out of excuses. So it looks like my lack of get-up-and-go is primarily due to the aging process, coupled with my own inherent lethargy, which can make things difficult to get up the energy once in a while. But then I check my email and find it full of comments, suggestions, and thank yous from so many of our fellow Saloners that my energy level shoots back up to the max, and, well, here we go again, getting ready to listen to the end of the Hazelwood House trialogue. And, again, today's program will be a bit longer than the 1 hour I like to keep them to, and so I want to be sure to get my thank yous in before you get lost in the thicket of thoughts that our merry trialoggers create. And in addition to Ralph, Rupert, Terrence, Bruce, and Shatul Hayuk, whose music you hear in the background right now, I also want to thank three people whose financial donations to the Salon have been significant. So, thank you very much, Elliot K., Jim, and my fellow grandfather, Robert O. And how's your little granddaughter doing, Robert? I'm sure she's bringing you as much joy as my grandchildren are bringing me. They really make my life worthwhile, and I'll bet it's the same with you. Anyway, thank you all for your support of these podcasts. I couldn't do it without all of your help, love, and support, and it's deeply appreciated. Well, for today's program, we'll be picking up where we last left the Hazelwood House trialogue that was held between Rupert Sheldrake, Terrence McKenna, and Ralph Abraham back in 1993. And we'll begin with Ralph's tale that he calls Fractals on My Mind. Now, as I've been listening to these trilogues with you over the past couple of years, I've come to expect to hear new insights about our physical world coming from Rupert and over-the-edge metaphysical ideas coming from Terrence. But throughout them all, it's been Ralph who quite often provides the steadiness or ballast or rudder or whatever you want to call it that gets their cargo of new ideas safely ashore. You know, I've got a good friend like that myself, and believe me, he's saved me from a lot of embarrassment on more than one occasion by forcing me to think through some outlandish statement that I'm about to make. And his advice is often the first I seek because I know he won't cut me any intellectual slack. In the realms we all seem to enjoy talking about, it really pays big dividends to have a well-grounded friend covering your back. And that's one of the roles I see Ralph playing here, and that is sort of the wise elder guiding a couple of precocious young friends. So it was kind of interesting for me that in the talk we're about to hear, I guess maybe about 10 minutes into it, is when Rupert points out the fact that we're actually listening to a lecture on mathematics in his Tale of Fractals. Well, I couldn't believe it at first, so I went back and listened to Ralph's talk again from the beginning and was blown away when I began to think of myself sitting in a college classroom and listening to a teacher who could actually inspire me to dig deeper into the beauty of mathematics in order to better understand how math directly impacts my everyday thinking, even my metaphysical thinking. And by the way, my undergraduate degree is in electrical engineering, so I had a lot of math along the way, but never was I taught by a poet who also happened to be a mathematician. Just listen with me right now, and I think you'll hear what I mean.
Fractals on my mind. An epic in four parts. Part one, the sandy beach. The three boys put on their wellies. They ran down the field. They swung on the swing. They rolled down the corn circle. They came to the river. They sat on the edge, dangling their feet over the stream. "Look," said Ruth, "a sandy beach." Sure enough, they saw there was a little tiny beach of sand. Terrence said, "The land reaches down into the water." And Rupert said, "No, the water reaches up into the land." Ralph said, "It's both water and sand. It's the sandy beach. It's a fractal object." They stood then. They walked in the stream. "Look," said Terrence. "It circles to the left." "No," said Rupert. "It circles to the right." "It's turbulent flow," said Ralph. "It's a mathematical object. It's chaos." On the other side of the stream, there was no beach. There was a concrete wall. It was not a fractal object. Rupert said, "It's a straight line." Terrence said, "It's a Bauhaus excrescent of post-linguistic humanoids." Thinking of peanut butter sandwiches then, they walked back up the slope. Rupert said, "Nature has given us a lesson. Nature is our teacher. We have learned about the sandy beach." The sun had set. Ralph pointed to the sky. "Look," he said. They looked and saw there was a silver stripe in the sky shining there. They hadn't noticed it before. It girdled the entire celestial vault. It sprung from two legs to the south. That way, they saw that its two legs pierced the zodiacal belt. It sprung across the mid-heaven, going somewhere near the polar constellations. Rupert said, "I think those constellations over there, those are all watery. That's the Pisces, the fish, this is biology projected on the sky." Terrence said, the Chaldean astrologers called that the celestial sea. And Ralph said, it's a sandy beach in the sky. Rup said, "Father Sky is our teacher too." Ralph said, "Well, there's a sphere above the sky with the sandy beach in it, and a kind of astral projection imprints its shadow on the celestial sphere and on the terrestrial disk as well." They went back to the kitchen and tugged off their wellies and looked for peanut butter in the fridge. That's part one, the sandy beach. Part two is called Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. This is about bird flight. So we have to recall that pigeons live in a loft, and the loft radiates a field throughout the atmosphere of the planet Earth, all the way around. And this is a field of intuitive flying instruction. Wherever a pigeon might be released, you can consult its intuition in its heart and see a snapshot of itself a moment later in a certain direction. And by following itself, it gets the instruction to fly in a certain direction, which, even though it's not a straight line, will eventually lead back to the loft, which is the attractor of the dynamical system or intuitive field of directions. And we'll assume this for the sake of discussion. This is the morphogenetic field of the loft. And now we have to put ourselves in the position of someone reading Rupert's book soon when it's published and trying to do the experiment with the movable loft. First we dispose of monotheism, leave that behind. Now we have two laws. The two laws each radiate a morphogenetic field, instructions, wherever the pigeon might be. That's the fixed loft at home and the movable one just taken off the truck or out of the boat or whatever it is. The pigeon has spent time in each loft and been trained and feels the impulse of the morphogenetic field of each in a combination averaged by mathematical functions built into the heart of the bird. The result is that after flying, the bird will arrive either at the fixed loft or at the movable loft, depending on where it starts. This is sort of a mathematical fact, but I hope that experimentalists will try this out. That would mean train a whole bunch of pigeons in the same fixed loft, in the same movable loft, and then releasing not all of them, but a certain proportion of them from different locations, sort of neighboring in a region, and later on marking the starting points in that region with the color red for all the starting points of birds that flew to the fixed loft, and green for all the birds that ended up in the movable loft. Then we end up with this region is painted part red and part green. So these colored regions in dynamical systems theory are called basins. The basins might be particularly important if you were of the gambling sort and were betting on a certain pigeon whether it would go to the one loft or the other. You could certainly win your bet if you knew this colored map from successive experiments with the same two lofts and flock of birds. Yes, I am talking about you. So it's important to know where the green and red regions are, and it could be all red over there, sort of toward the home loft, which is in the south, and all green over there toward the movable loft, which is in the north. But it could be much more complicated because during flight there are all these hills you have to go around, and there's certain nests of sparrowhawks that have to be avoided by a wide detour. And one possibility is that between the red and the green regions there is a sharp line like that Bauhaus concrete wall on the other side of the river. And another possibility is that the red and green have been stirred and mixed like the colors on this carpet into a pattern with the boundary as a fractal object, as a sandy beach. A sandy beach in the morphogenetic field, so that the separation between the red and green, which might mean life and death, might be the red eschaton and the green eschaton, is a fractal. And that means that whatever you would be in the supposed boundary, like wherever you are on the sandy beach, if you are a pinhead, you might be either in water or on land. And even the tiniest puff of wind could blow you from land to water or vice versa. So unless it was an entirely windless day, you couldn't even predict whether you're going to end up in the home roost or the movable roost, in life or death, in the good or the bad eschaton. It's the fractal boundary, the sandy beach, which destroys determinism. The Milky Way is, as a mythological object, is Tiamat, is the early Assyrian goddess of chaos. And her mate, Apsu, are those two branches of the rivers, which is a projection of the Tigris and the Euphrates. The identification of chaos and the Milky Way and Tiamat and indeterminacy and the creative source of all form is traditional, at least for 6,000 years. I didn't make up this fable. That's the end of part two. Two roads diverge in a yellow wood. These two roads are the red and the green. You might as well toss a coin because you can't get where you're going on purpose. That, down at the river, and that's the homing pigeons. We're pigeons, and the Eskaton is our home, Terence would say. And now let's take a deep breath. We've survived two lessons of mathematics without the despicable, frightening word being mentioned. And now on to apply the concepts in the context of a single individual mind. So we have in mind different parts, which are somehow dynamical objects, where there's a cycling about, a roving over, that repeats a pattern or follows a track for a long time until we get out of that track into another one. This could be an entire paradigm, whatever that is. Let's say a paradigm is a bunch of basins. Like, instead of the red and the green, we could have 100 different colors, all of them kind of mixed up fractally, like this rug. And each of these colored regions might be a group of basins, but between the basins are thicker boundaries that make it more difficult to go through, reflect you from the boundary, so that it takes a bigger perturbation in the world of thought in order to change it. We could call them paradigms, or personalities, or cubby holes in the mind. For example, when language came over us, I don't mean 25,000 years ago, well, this process started 25,000 years ago, but in the history of a single individual, then at the age of one or two or three or something, when speech is beginning, what was going on before that? Presumably that was what everyone was doing before speech came altogether, if there ever was such a time, and that childhood paradigm is not vaporized and replaced when the linguistic phase arrives. Instead, it's like covered over and covered. It just makes another one of these bases. So that's an example of, we could call it multiple personality. And these regions in the mind, normally, should be, the boundaries should be fractal. That is to say, more like the sandy beach than like the Bauhaus concrete wall. In the case that some training influence creates, instead of the natural sandy beach, a concrete wall, then it becomes very difficult to get from one to another. When there would be fractal beaches everywhere, then the slightest perturbation, a strange idea coming on the radio, would bop you just that millimeter, sorry, fraction of an inch, to get from the water to the sand, from the one paradigm to another. In a normal day in the life, with a lot of perturbations, one would rapidly be visiting them, all of the different regions or multiple personalities making up the self. So noise in the environment is sufficient to integrate the personality, but if there are iron curtains here and there, then it takes a very big perturbation to get out of one paradigm into another, and then you would see an individual manifesting the multiple personality syndrome. So since this difficulty, at least in this model, which is inspired by Kurt Levine, the founder of social psychology, he had a kind of mathematical model for a mind, individual or social, at the basis of his invention of social psychology. In this model, the healthier state has these sandy beaches, and the basins, the colors are all mixed up. The pathological state has too much order, like after toilet training or something, with these concrete walls, iron curtains. So these iron curtains, I call them dischaos. So replacing the order disorder binary with the dischaos and chaos binary, because we need more sandy beaches. So I wouldn't call this, as they do, the multiple personality disorder. I call it the multiple personality dischaos. So that's a sandy beach model of a mind, which if we were into clinical psychology, we could try developing, inventing a therapeutic strategy to increase chaos. For example, visiting a river, listening to the sound, walking in nature, as opposed to listening to the radio and watching the TV. Watching TV would be good if they somehow put birdsong on there, chanting. So, there are many applications of this that I won't go into now. I'll just mention a possible application we could come back to someday, just, you know, to point to some possibilities for individual psychology before I go on to the fourth and final lap of this course. And this has to do with the question, why do people believe in UFOs? Or why do people want to believe in corn circles? Or this is quite independent of whether UFOs are real or imaginary. It hardly matters, and not to put down UFOs. And why they would want to believe in God or monotheism, or if there is one God, and so on. I think that the multiple personality dischaos phenomenon is pretty universal in our culture. And there are heavily walled off regions. Walls were built at different stages in life, and the child part was sealed when there was an authoritarian, trustworthy emotional environment that had the illusion of absolute truth or something. So that part is sitting there yearning for some validation from the outside world. Something like that would, if you wanted to try experiments, or you could write a book recommending experiments in social psychology in which the tendency of people to believe in God, you could try to affect it by playing music. Music therapy for dischaotic religious belief. And in case of success, then restore pantheism, which is maybe badly needed at this time. Instead of going on with applications to fractals in the individual mind, I'd like to just go on to the collective mind, to our social sphere, and in this fourth and final part, and then I'll end with a couple of questions for you guys based on this idea. Well, I wouldn't have thought of this exactly, but I think Terence suggested that I was guilty of making a mathematical model for monogamy. And since that's true, I might as well share it with you. and this is it, in fact. We are there. So this is about the sandy beach in the collective mind. And, well, we could get to this collective mind stepwise, as in the Zhuangzi. One, from nothing comes one, and then two, and then three, he says, after three, any mathematician can make infinity. So we've got one, now we can just step to two. And what would be then the application of the Sandy Beach model to a social system consisting of two people? Now you have the two people, and there's some kind of mathematical model for the psyche. Not to be taken too seriously, but this is just what psychology does, makes Kurt Levine type models for the psyche, and now you've got like two of them, and then they start talking to each other touching, cooking and eating together, or something like that, and then these two systems are coupled in to one. And of course, the behavior of the coupled system is much more complicated than the behavior of the parts, and the behavior of the coupled up complex system can't be predicted or even guessed at from the full knowledge of the behavior of the two parts. And besides, you would only know one of the parts if you were involved in this to a degree. This system then also has, this is a dynamical system, I mean the model is, not the people, and in the model this complex system has attractors, that is to say roost, loft, the movable loft, the fixed loft, and so on, and the bases colored red, green, and all the other things, and the boundaries in between, either iron curtains or sandy beaches. And I suppose that monogamy means a contract or behavioral epiphenomenon in which some of the boundaries between the parts are heavily walled off, so that it is, as a matter of fact, a situation, unstable situation of dischaos. I'm not saying that order is always bad, but cosmos and chaos just have to be balanced. I wouldn't elevate chaos above cosmos or vice versa, but systems probably to be healthy, they need a certain balance, and understanding monogamy as an iron curtain, then to make it stable would require a balancing chaos elsewhere. Something that's the idea. Otherwise, this multiple personality that's the system of the two people would have the multiple personality dischaos and out of balance situation in the direction of order, which, like the concrete wall doing its best to hold up the bank for life, is highly unstable. That's one application. Then, I won't go into details, but considering two nations instead of two individuals, one also gets a model of this sort, in which the stability of the complex system would require adequate balance of chaos and order. So those are the four parts, and let me just end with these questions for Rupert and Hare. So, Rupert, this model suggests that you have to consider experiments with multiple lofts, and even with a single loft, have to consider experiments with multiple pigeons. And anyway, that's a consequence of your idea, your model of what is going on. And so I wonder what you think the results, maybe you already know of results of this that have been tried. It could, for the ancient Egyptian government, of course, mean the success or failure in the war with the Hyksos. And for Terence, I think, I just wonder what would this do to your idea to consider multiple attractors at the end of time, two, three, or more eschatons. Nothing in what you said seemed to me prohibited this, other than a misplaced iron curtain of the monotheistic type that perhaps filtered the speech of the mushroom that came through your lips.
I see. Well,
there you have it.
Can I just try and summarize, Ralph, what I think you said, because I'm not sure I've got it.
Okay.
One element seems to be that personalities and, of course, social relationships and international relations and the behavior of different groups of pigeons fall into different basins. And we can visualize that like being a landscape with different valleys in it. And so if something's in a particular region, the ball will roll down in a particular valley. If it's another region, it will roll into another one. And each of these basins represents a different kind of sub-personality. Within a marriage or a relationship, then each of the basins represents what we normally call a personality, each of which has sub-personalities within it. these are the different basins, and you seem to be pointing out that personalities are made up of different sub-personalities, a very fashionable view. Everybody is talking about sub-personalities. James Hillman says we need a polytheistic psychology where you have all the different gods and goddesses, not only representing the archetypes that we all go through, all these different ones. We're possessed by different gods or goddesses at different times, and we move from one to another, and we're not a single personality with different functions, but we're a kind of emulsion of all these different personalities. Then there's the multiple personality craze in America, where people are fascinated not just by serial killers, but by people with multiple personalities, and preferably both. You know, multiple personalities, serial killers. Anyway, there's a fascination with multiple personality. There's the Hillman thing, there's the computer model, Minsky and the MIT multiple module. Daniel Dennett, the materialist philosopher, has the multiple graph theory of consciousness. So everywhere we find these multiple models, of which yours is one. And all of them seem to be saying that to get away from monotheism, which is reflected in psychology, but by the idea of a central ego, a dominating ego, you've got to get away from that too. So these more democratic models, where you have kind of grassroots democracy, all these different personalities, that seems to be one drift in what you're saying. And that's another one discussion, is whether or not a polytheistic model is possible, or whether indeed there have been any. Because in India, which is frequently called polytheistic, you have many gods, but you have all through all Indian traditions the idea of some state beyond all this, Brahma or Atman. And in every system where you actually have polytheism, you have some sense of an undifferentiated unity as well. So that's one point to discuss. The second point you'll seem to be making is that the boundary between these different basins is not a straight line or a rigid wall, but rather a fractal boundary, namely one that has many ins and outs and curves and filigrees and patterns, and therefore moving with that kind of boundary, moving from one to the other is very easy, because you never quite know where you are, and you could cross the boundary without realizing it, whereas if there's a rigid wall, it's difficult to get from one to the other. Is this so far?
Yes.
Right. Well, I'm not sure which points to take up first. I think I'll leave pigeons aside for the time being. But I think the idea of the plurality of models, I mean, I'm sure this is, you're right, Terence's model is monotheistic, in that he has a single eschaton. And this takes us immediately to the plurality, to the polytheism versus monotheism argument. My view of polytheism is that polytheism in all its actual functional forms, even in its Catholic form, Catholicism is in a sense a kind of polytheism. You have all the angels, you have all the saints, you go into the cathedral, there's all those side chapels and shrines. It's just like a Hindu temple. You go into a Hindu temple, there's the goddess of this, then there's the god of the planets, the god planet gods, and then there'll be this goddess and this local god, and then there's Ganesh, and then there's various other gods, Hanuman, and that there'll be a central shrine, say of Shiva or of Vishnu, which would represent the central unifying principle. So most forms of polytheism are not radical polytheism. They're a plurality with some, however vaguely defined, overarching unity behind them. So the first point is, are you denying an overarching unity?
No.
A radical polytheism?
I think my main message is what you described as the second point. It has to do with the rigidity of boundaries in between. I think that everybody would agree that there's plurality in religion, in life, in the mind, in the stream, in the sky, and so on. And I think it's more important the rigidity of the boundaries in between. Do you worship in the Shiva temple and then you go to Ram? Is that okay? Or do you have to be faithful to one and never admit the existence of others and so on? It's more the denial of what obviously to children seems to exist that brings about a disintegration of the personality?
Through excessively rigid boundaries rather than fractile boundaries between things.
Yes.
It's easy to go from one to the other.
Yes. They're porous to the point of, I mean, when you're in the stream, it's much more watery than when you're on land, but the job of getting into the stream doesn't really have a shock of cold water in it, because it's like a permeable membrane, I guess, between basins. And I think in this religious or mythological context, it's appropriate to think of Shiva and concepts of that sort as attractors. And then there's multiple attractors, everybody knows, considering the population of the planet through all times at large, and there's zillions of attractors, and some people have visited one, and other people have visited two or three, and so on. And this openness, I guess I would say, to all attractors is some kind of prerequisite for stability, for the longevity of a culture or the health of an individual. And this idea is based on the cosmology, in which the stream has the same morphology as the heavens, which have the same morphology as some abstract mathematical object.
Mm.
Therefore, under the ambience of this idea, our experience of nature is that these rigid walls are very unstable.
But they're not that unstable. If you look at nature, if you look at a plant, for example, there's sort of membranes around its leaves. And although they have invaginations, stomata, and the air can go in, the surface is our skin, has pores in it, and is not absolutely smooth. But nevertheless, these are clear functional boundaries. And everywhere you look in biology, you find clear functional boundaries. There's a cell membrane around each cell, which may have within the lipid structure, the fatty structure, some kind of fractile nature. But it's not an infinitely permeable boundary. It has it's permeable to a point.
Well, it has little holes in it with pumps, which are designed for particular things in the environment.
Mm.
So the permeability is, as it were, structured in a way that's rigidly connected with that species.
Mm.
But if these holes were plugged up with chewing gum or something, then of course the cell would instantly die.
But hmm. Boundaries, you're not denying the importance of boundaries, of course. Your whole model is based on boundaries, isn't it?
That's right. It has to do with their crookedness.
And their crookedness is your mathematical model for their permeability.
Yes.
Okay, we've got it straight now, but I want to hear how it applies.
Yes, well, it seems... I think the hay fever medication must be cutting in. It seems extraordinarily arcane. Nature is fractal, and this is the new discovery, and it's a very powerful insight, but it doesn't wipe out some of the previous accomplishments. I'm thinking of all the work that was done to show that it's also hierarchical. So without tossing the baby out with the bathwater, it might be better to say it's fractal and hierarchical, so that in the case of your suggestion to me that the eschaton could be many, I think the eschaton is defined as one. And so the many that you're suggesting are sort of subsets of the approach. And then what I'm hearing is that because of the interdimensionality of the fractal, the boundary transition is, it's as Philo Judaeus said of the more perfect logos, you can never tell the moment when it crosses over from being heard to being seen. That's another one of these fractal boundaries that you're talking about. Well, if that were all there were to say about it, then no boundary would be defined or noticed. perceived as such. So we're sort of back to Whitehead's notion of certain stubborn facts that are, I suppose, like raisins of resistance embedded in this fractal ocean of infinite permeability. I don't have any problem with this. But nevertheless, I think above all these cycles, boundaries, membrane, there is ultimately a frame that is all-inclusive and defined. As far as my, you know, whether this is simply because I've imbibed some form of monotheism on the side, possibly. The form that I've probably fallen under the sway of is some kind of Neoplatonic pyramid of ever-ascending abstract hypostatizations that lead into the One. I mean, if what we mean by the eschaton is the absence of boundaries, then what we're saying is that the fractalization of reality occurs ultimately on such fine scales that from the point of view of the perceiver, the boundary has dissolved completely, or the boundary and the thing bound have become so homogenized that it no longer makes sense to speak of boundary and medium. You can only speak of this, I picture it as a kind of extremely marbleized liquid or surface where every domain can be found to be lying next to a mutually exclusive other domain, and they're sort of like the kinds of diagrams that you get in when you carry out four-color mapping problems to fourth and fifth stages of resolution. Then you have these extraordinarily complicated structures where every point lies next to the boundary that separates it from points that have been somehow defined as other. I'm not sure that we have any disagreement here. What is it?
I think what we've got here in your description is a speculation built upon a speculation built upon a speculation and coming eventually from some kind of absolute and pure faith.
To my Neoplatonists,
the One to Plotinus was something that you could explore toward but not actually arrive at. So we have to understand then on the testimony of those early experts that One is an article of faith and our experience. Even the best traveling shaman has only been so far. And the assumption of One beyond that is, as a matter of fact, pure, faithful monotheism at its best. It's even called the One. God is called the One to make sure that you don't think perhaps is two.
Right.
Now, I agree with your idea that the cosmos is hierarchical. That's fine with me. And even I don't care if it has a finite number of layers or an infinite number. But however far you would go, that the wildest shaman has traveled has seen only another image, maybe more complex, of what we see in ordinary reality and nature. And that is, there are multiple basins, there are fractal boundaries, there are many possibilities, there are different regions, there's complexity, where harmony is hierarchically organized. We have never got to the top. Therefore, to say it's one or it's two or it's three could only be an article of faith. It cannot be any kind of extrapolation from observation, normal or arcane observation. We're talking about pure faith here. When you get to the top frame, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't have two basins, and they're separated by a fractal, and that means that the shaman who comes back and says he knows which one it is lying.
Well, my understanding of fractals is that they are a kind of homogenization of levels, not present, domains, distant, and that in fact the idea is if you have a sufficient sample of the fractal, not very large, you can in fact extrapolate the contours of the entire system, so that it isn't necessary to send a shaman or a mathematician for a total overview. The sample can be, isn't this what the cosmological principle is, that based on local measurement and local physics, it is allowed to extrapolate.
There's another monotheistic religion, which is yours in reverse, which says instead of an eschaton, it's got a birth at the beginning. Without an article of faith, you can't get a cosmological principle. We don't have any evidence from the boundaries of space.
Well, isn't the idea that fractals are a kind of holographic plan, that the pattern recurs on many, many levels, but it's always the same pattern? So if you have 10 levels and you know the pattern on 2 through 7, you know the pattern on 1, 8, 9, and 10.
No, few fractals in nature have that property, which is a special property of special fractals, which are self-similar fractals, which are, as it were, like integers within the field of all real numbers. They are exceptional, self-similar fractals, mostly. It just means you have the two basins, red and green, and their boundary is kind of stirred up so that it has the following property. Wherever you are in it, you're within 1 millimeter of each side, or even a tenth of a millimeter of each side.
Like in a mapping.
Like in a cantercept.
Well, I guess I somehow have limited my model building to the use of self-similar
just like practice. Pythagoras.
Is this so terrible?
I'm not sure if we allowed you self-similarity in the eschaton, if that would still establish to everyone's satisfaction there's only one.
Well, in my model of the eschaton, it is, at the mathematical level, it is self-similar.
Well, there's this, let me tell you about the water principle. If you had three basins fractally entwined, then not only wherever you are in the sandy beach, you're within 1 millimeter of the red and green, but the yellow one is there also. That means if you travel as a shaman and then you see this pattern at the end of time, if there would be any jitter in your travel, any blur in your vision, anything slightly human remaining in your travel, then you would see it as one, even though it isn't. You just like mistakenly see it as a blur of the three colors into a kind of a gray eschaton.
Well, in some circles, this is known as the mystery of the Holy Trinity. Theological attempts to deal with this problem have led to a variety of models where you have the idea that the ultimate is not an undifferentiated unity, but rather a pattern of relationships, which in the Chinese model you have the yin and the yang, the kind of fractal model between them, and the circle containing the two is the whole that unifies them. And in the model of the Holy Trinity, there's a lot of different ways of dealing with it, but one way is the Father is the source of the Word and the Spirit. And the Word is the primary model, is the spoken Word. The Spirit is the breath on which you speak the Word. You breathe out, and as you speak, the Word can happen. Of course, the spoken Word, not the written Word. And this, as Jill would tell us, is a pattern of vibrations with harmonics and so on, probably some kind of fractal pattern in time. And it would be hard to say which is the breath and which is the sound, and how you can separate the vibration from the sound and so on. That would seem to be the kind of model in another very different form that you have in mind. But the principle of unity is not there so much. It's partly, I suppose, a kind of experience people report, but it's also the sense that all these things are related or hold together. The unity comes from the sense of interrelationship rather than perceiving some kind of undifferentiated sphere. Because all these models of an ultimate unity are models of a relationship within, which, you know, something holds them together. Now, your model seems to me similar, because the hidden agenda behind your model is that although these fractals set these boundaries, and although you can have any number of boundaries, and although you can't see a unity within these boundaries, the hidden unity behind all this is the equation governing the fractals. Mm. And for mathematicians, the equation governing the fractals. Because you see, as a mathematical object, mathematicians have this representation. You can look on a computer screen at the fractal pattern, but behind that fractal pattern is a program, and behind that program is an equation. And when it comes to equations, mathematicians would certainly admit there can be many different equations, many mathematical functions. But for this given fractal pattern, there's presumably one equation governing it, and that contains different elements, but they're related together by the equals sign of the equation, and by the whole structure of the equation is a kind of unity containing diversity as a mathematical object, which for most mathematicians exists in some kind of platonic realm between beyond space and time. Even if this platonic realm is only in the imagination of mathematicians, there's some kind of hidden unity containing the diversity that generates this entire thing we've been talking about. So I would say the unity is implicit in any mathematical model, in the hidden mathematical object behind the manifested pattern.
Well, that's true, but it still makes a difference if you fly to the home roost where your mate is, or you fly to the mobile loft where there's just this army captain waiting to give you your food. I think that my point is not so much about the multiplicity or unity. I agree that everything is unified in one thing, at least the better if it is. The point is more about the boundaries, that if you have the dynamical system with the different basins, and they have fractal boundaries with the water property, then, as a matter of fact, no matter how you perceive it, no matter what experiment you do, you will perceive unity. When you don't perceive unity is in the pathological case when you have the iron curtains. If you have iron curtains, then unity essentially has been defeated by a disease of dischaos. And therefore, when we see this in nature, in history, in social systems, and in ourselves, we have to beware about these iron curtains, because they create, as it were, a unnecessarily multiple situation, which is the multiple personality syndrome, which is a real problem for some people and is a problem to some extent for all people. As we have, for example, here, expressed a yearning for a peaceful state beyond language, then I'm calling that one of these boundaries. And if you practice chanting, meditation, and so on, then you are intentionally increasing the fractality of the boundary, and therefore the integration of the parts into the unity. If unity is your goal, then you have to examine the fractal width of all your boundaries and guard against things that are too thin.
So how do you fractalize your boundaries? Can you give a personal example?
Well, in the emerging science of neural nets, this is called annealing. Well, one thing you can do is take a psychedelic. Another thing you can do is go to a different culture, which is really, really different, and stay there for 7 years on a farm or something. And
just live with your life.
Well, if you have,
for courage.
Have a mate of any gender, then you're certainly in a more chaotic situation than... But these two-person units do definitely have diseases, we know that, and a few of them survive. And I'm making a suggestion here as to what's the trouble, which might not be validated by further study, but to the degree that it would suggest a strategy, a kind of a therapeutic technique. And people are trying out, by the way, this idea for therapy in relationships.
Can you give an example of how it would work in the therapy in a relationship? The fractalization of boundaries. Not in the model, but I mean in a kind of therapeutic personal
Right. Well, people, first of all, there's a diagnostic phase in which the therapist is trained in chaos theory instead of Freudian theory. And when a boundary has been detected with a pathologically low dimension or thickness, then a therapy has to be devised specially for it, and that would consist of some carefully, some safeguarded experiments in the violation of the boundary and the mixing of the boundaries. One common strategy involves play in a sandbox. You've seen this. Therapist's office has all these toys, and that returns to a pre-verbal mode of expression. And well, there people are clever at therapies. I'm not a therapist, but I think that an advance in theory is helpful in devising therapies. Now, what's happening with this fad of multiples in the United States is that people who suffer this are getting together in a small group for self-therapy because they feel that the therapist, not having multiple personality chaos, has no idea really what's going wrong. So the theory coming from the therapist can't possibly be right. So these groups are studying chaos theory, and the therapy that they've devised is a psychodrama, which they write, direct, and perform in public in sort of street theaters in cities around the United States. There's a network of these that base their approach on my paper on the multiple, what is it called, personality dyschaos, it's called. So we'll see. I can give you a report next year how these experiments work out. Some therapists believe that they may be fatal and I should be imprisoned. But the patients themselves are very enthusiastic. They're really having such a wonderful time. It applies to bipolarity. You know, depression is a really serious condition. If you're depressed, I mean, you are so unhappy, so life is so painful, you can't really go on. And if a therapy was devised that cured bipolar personality dyschaos without drugs, then a lot of people would be helped. This is, it's not a fad, it's a really serious disease.
So dyschaos, the psychodrama is designed to break down boundaries, rigid boundaries.
Yes, to increase their fractal dimension.
What do you do with people whose boundaries are too low already? Are there certain people, for example, in conversation, who run from one attractor or create or basin to another, so they jump from subject to subject with alarming rapidity and you can barely keep up? Now these seem to be people who have highly fractals of high dimension in their mental attractor structure. What do you do with them to reduce the dimensions of their fractal?
Well, I'd start with beer or maybe a shandy and then go on to wine.
So, Ralph, given what you've said about the goals of this therapy, wouldn't it just be simpler to give these people psychedelics?
Well, personally, I've had good results with psychedelics. No, I'm not sure everyone would. And maybe there... Well, it'd be nice if we had several alternative strategies, some of which could be done on a Sunday evening where you still feel okay about going to work on Monday morning.
Well, since you have such,
like vitamin pills,
since you have such good luck with psychedelics, why are you so reluctant to advocate?
Well, I do. I have been advocating psychedelics in public, or at least, if not advocating, confessing that for me there have been very good results. I've had a certain amount, quite recently, of hostile mail and telephone calls, even people coming to the university to hasten my demise. They seem to think they're drugs. The psychedelics are drugs, and the there's also the aspect of legality, where many people are in jail with 20, 30, and 40-year jail sentences. So I think that the atmosphere of paranoia in the world today might even make them much less effective as medicine for this chaos and psychodrama and therapy.
So because of the paranoia, the legal status. But if that barrier were removed, and it sounds like you're advocating something fairly close to what Salvador Roquette and that school settled into. Is that true?
I don't know Salvador Roquette.
Well, he was a psychotherapist who worked in Mexico for many years and gives people psychedelics, but he also then assaults them with Auschwitz footage and all of the very highly charged emotional material, the idea being to just reduce them to some absolutely basic jelly of dissolved boundaries and psychic.
Sounds disgusting.
To me, I agree. I'm trying to find out how what you're advocating is different.
Oh, it takes only very subtle medicine to decrease rigid walls. Even the very idea of it may be enough, as a matter of fact. Well, that's anyway the therapy idea. Once your consciousness is adjusted so that your sensitivity to your own process actually observes these things and considers them undesirable, then automatically they begin to disappear under the self-creative action of one's own psyche. After all, nature is there too, and mathematical necessity reveals itself in the Milky Way, in the sandy beach, and in the human psyche as well. There is a tendency toward health. I think that these diseases of the rigid barriers, like other diseases, consist primarily of the rejection of the cure, and the cure can be found within. Unlike hay fever and a lot of things, this can actually be treated within. One has to get the idea. Thus, when people suffer this, which is essentially universal, it is an inheritance from a culture which has the disease itself. So the cure consists of identifying the difficulty as essentially a cultural pattern and then disowning it by becoming more of an expatriate of your own culture. That's why visiting another culture and living there, even for 3 months, is sometimes enough to liberate people from a rigid pattern.
So the diagnosis comes very close to the 19th century diagnosis for most difficulties is a few months at the seashore, in Italy preferably. In other words, in both cases, you want to establish this extra environmental attitude through distance from cultural values, either achieved through journeys
nature,
to drugs,
yes,
or journeys to foreign
a walk
and exotic
in the woods
lands.
Is perhaps all it takes.
So it's a search for perspective achieved by distancing.
It's a kind of a mathematical perspective.
Yeah, well, is there another
it's only
kind?
Appropriate because our culture has suffered this particular disease over a mere span of 6,000 years. That's all we have to recover from.
The particular disease being boundary anxiety?
Patriarchal, monotheistic, hierarchical.
Well,
constipated, linear,
toilet train,
etc. Yes, but is there any culture that has managed to avoid this chaos?
Well, I think so, but I don't have exact experience of Aboriginal cultures. The one we live in has by now covered the entire globe, and the exceptions are near to extinction. But there are some. Anthropologists used to go and study wild tribes before they were contacted by the external civilization now dominating the entire sphere, which arrived unfortunately to them in the form of this anthropologist, which was the kiss of death for that culture. And
so what you're suggesting, Ralph, is that archaic lifestyles were more boundaries, which is a theme near and dear to me. I mean, yes. Certainly in living Amazon cultures, one of the hardest things to put up with when you're there is the fact that there are no boundaries. You know, that everybody lives in a wall-less grand house. Defecation, sexuality, death, domestic hassling, disciplining of children, everything goes on in the presence of everyone else, and no one from age 6 to 90 feels any constraint whatsoever about making comments, suggestions, and offering free advice. It's a hard thing to embrace, even with the knowledge that it's going to be good for you.
Well, there are degrees of boundaries, but I think the permeability of the boundaries is important, and our culture has perhaps excess attention devoted to the walled fortress necessitated by the violence of these people, which some would associate with the patriarchy and so-called testosterone poisoning and whatever it is. There has been the necessity of Bauhaus concrete walls around the town, locks on the doors of the houses, electronic motion detectors, video cameras at the bank card place, and so on. Our culture is perhaps, there's an increase of complexity as we approach the eschaton. Perhaps there's a decrease in that the fractality is actually vanishing at an alarming rate. That's what it means, the death of nature.
But Ralph, when I last visited your house in Santa Cruz, I noticed a rigid, straight fence dividing your property from your very undesirable neighbours who have motorcycle scrambles on their land and make terrible noise.
Yes, they're all boys with guns, that's right.
That's right. Well, what we need here is a new product, the fractal fence, which would go down very well in California. Some boundary instead of old-style posts with barbed wire.
Excellent. Sort of mazes where people get lost. I think we should patent this and get on with it. We'll subvert the world.
Well, then, just for the slightest blow, gust of wind or chaotic event, these motorcycles would suddenly zoom past your front door.
Yes. We'd have these gateways like cell membranes have that nice people could go right through. Those with spirit guides.
So, haven't we reached the point, right?
I think we could.
Yes.
Is it okay?
Yes.
Let's have some questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's go.
Yes, well, everyone is stuck there. We, it's a Janus. We have our individuality perceived according to our own paradigm, which is a paradigm of individuality, and then there is our participation in a group, another group, and the larger group, and so on, which is the study of cultural anthropology or sociology, and we don't know sometimes if our individuality actually exists, and other times we don't know if we belong to any network at all. So we could perhaps think of these as two faces, as it were. That means that each one is itself a paradigm. That means that these different paradigms exist simultaneously within us. The individual paradigm, where my neighbors say, I can do anything I want on my own property, and including smoking tobacco, well, the other one says, I exist for the group, or the group is punishing me now, or I better get up and cook for the group, and so on, and a lot of other ones. And the important thing is that if you adopt this view of the self
or individual, as a structure, which, like all of these levels, are part of the structure, and that's the self, at least from the point of view of a single point in it, if you're looking from a single point, which is probably a different point for each of those personalities, then this whole structure, well, that's it. That's the self, and it's also the group, seen from different points. If you insist on logical consistency, compatibility, harmony between all these different individuals, then you're in trouble, because then you're trying to impose a structure on it, say logical consistency, which is impossible, and which, if you're obsessed with it, if you're insistent upon it, can only result in the rejection of the consciousness of those certain personalities, which then vanish under the carpet, where they move around sort of controlling the show without any supervision. So this is, I think, a really important aspect of the peculiarity of our culture, that back in those Neoplatonic times, we had Plato and Aristotle. They argued. They had completely different parts, like one is north-south, the other is east-west or something. Together, they give a good map, the transmission of the Greek miracle over time through early Christianity and early Islam, gave, by means of some historical accident, a phenomenal imbalance, accentuation to the Aristotelian, that is, the perspective of formal logic, that is, the insistence upon absolute truth, that is, the perversity of modern science, that's the Aristotelian, unfortunately, without the balance of the Platonic. When this Aristotelian imbalance aspect of our culture comes into our own psyche, we then may ask for, with our different parts, some logical compatibility, and that's a very unhealthy state. So we can accept the individual and the social without conflict, even though they're conflicting, just because they are, and their partnership too is.
Yeah, it sounds great. Terrence was suggesting everybody take 5 grams of dried mushrooms. Maybe one of these little balls under the tongue would do. So I might take this opportunity to speak in defense about the image of mathematics that you projected, and I think that this could be helpful to everyone, because I don't know how many people have come to me and said, I hope it won't be too mathematical. Mathematics is not a science. It's sort of the opposite of a science. Science is science. You know what that is, or we don't know. There's a lot of different images, but somehow it has to do with an absolute truth observed about nature by doing it a certain way with a discipline which is miraculously good in terms of getting rid of a lot of foggy stuff and giving all people on the planet a consensus about what's going on. Not speaking down science, but the science is not mathematical, and mathematics is not science. Science is discovered about the world through the activity of people. Mathematics is an inborn ability that everybody has, like breathing, pumping the blood, we don't know how it works, and so on. It is not an equation behind the picture you see in the book. The picture that you see in the book, which you recognize and it immediately means something to you in terms of what you're doing, that's the mathematics. Mathematics is an abstract vocabulary of space-time patterns. That's all. If somebody figured out some cute way to stuff into an equation or a computer diskette or something, they're fine. But computer graphics has made visible mathematics, like slide projector put into Terrence's head would project the shadow of the eschaton onto the wall. That's it. So everybody can do it. The story I told about the three boys at the beach, that's mathematics.
I think once you understand what mathematics is, every single one of us before lunch could invent a new branch of mathematics. Mathematics is simply the formal relationships between defined sets. And you can define the sets. You know, they could be hexagrams, they could be triangles, they could be groups of 11 dots. You set up the terms and then watch the system run and derive the rules, and that's a new branch of
it
language.
Doesn't need language. It's pre-linguistic. Children can do it. As soon as you've observed a similarity between the left bank of the stream and the right bank, between the right bank and the Milky Way, and so on, you are performing mathematical functions, and each that's all there is to it, except that somehow the subject has been misunderstood on such a massive scale within the school system that everyone's been convinced incorrectly that they can't do mathematics. And that's everyone, including Nobel Prize winning physicists and so on, have math anxiety because of the school system. Then there is no chaos and there is no order. Chaos is a kind of order. An order is a kind of chaos. So I know this sounds like double talk, but the whole idea is just to somehow disabuse yourself of the habit of overemphasizing something by perceiving the value in the other. You know, Jung psychoanalyzed God. This was bold. I think it was the last book before he died. Answer to Job. He psychoanalyzed God. He psychoanalyzed Yahweh, and he found a fractal mixture of two basins, good and evil, that can't exist without. That is, in other words, the ultimate model behind all the mathematical models for all the dichotomies before construction or after deconstruction. That is the red and green fractally mixed. They're still red, they're still green, but they're so close together. That's, anyway, Jung's deconstruction of Yahweh. Yes. Well, this is, I think, what Rupert was suggesting at one point there, the idea about the sacred trinity or the original tripartite structure of the goddess. Each part is present in every part, and there, in other words, no distinction between the divine world and the mundane world. And if there is a distinction, where a culture has made a distinction, then that distinction is, as it were, creating dis-ease in the culture by setting aside divinity from something else, ordinary reality, family, life, and then you get a temple with a thick concrete wall around it, and the divinity within and outside, and so on. Then there's the progressive parturation of, like unzipping a zipper, where one thing after another is desacralized, and now we live in a world which is totally desacralized, and the resacralization of the world could be as simple as zipping up this zipper again, but we don't know exactly where the handle is. We can't recover the aboriginal state of consciousness because it's extinct, I guess.
But we're trying.
But we're trying to find it in this. The multiple personality idea then suggests that it's there. It's still there in each person, under the wall.
The aboriginal state of consciousness involves, as far as we know, taboos. In other words, boundaries of what's restricted. It's not without boundaries at all. All the early books on anthropology, Sir James Frazer and all those kind of people, were fascinated by taboo structures. As soon as anthropologists arrived anywhere, they found systems of taboos, and that's why early 20th century anthropology, Freud wrote a book on totem and taboo, and very interested in this question. And taboo means that which is forbidden. And the idea that there are these boundaries set up by culture seems utterly fundamental to all cultures.
Well, but don't you think...
Not just patriarchal, etc.
Don't you think they were projecting a lot of that? After all, people like James Frazer and Freud came from the most taboo-ruled societies that have ever existed on Earth. Victorian England and fin de siècle Vienna were so taboo-obsessed, so constipated, so hidden from themselves, that they very probably carried that into their work as a projection.
But not just that. I mean, like among Australian Aborigines, the idea that there are certain initiation rites that boys go through when they're shown certain objects which can only be seen by initiated men, not by women, mm-hmm. not by boys beneath the age of initiation. And this kind of pattern, presumably, wasn't just made up by anthropologists. These things are found everywhere, things of that general kind. And the idea of boundaries seems fundamental to human culture, and the boundaries in so-called primitive societies are much more rigid than in our own in many ways. And like in India, for example, the boundary between the left and the right hand. You use your left hand for wiping your bottom after going to the lavatory, and it's considered unclean and pure and so on, with an actual daily reinforcement of that reality. You use your right hand for eating, and if you give someone a present, you must give it with the right hand. I was always having to tell my guests in India, for heaven's sake, don't give people things with your left hand. They're in the shop, pay with the money. You just don't do that. And you have to learn all these cultural divisions when you go and live in another culture. It's not just that we're obsessed with boundaries, we're in fact in our culture, many of them have been broken down. So I think there's something extremely important about these boundaries, which your fractal model...
Well, I never spoke against the boundaries, I think that...
No, they're not even fractal-like. In traditional cultures, they seem, the ones I've encountered, haven't had a kind of fractal, permeable quality. They've had a quality of extreme authority to them.
Well, this suggestion, I think, about Aboriginal society had to do with the presence of the divine throughout the world, a view you share, I think. And that's one particular boundary that we have that those traditional societies didn't have, even though they had other ones. So maybe there's a law of the conservation of boundaries, or the maintenance of a certain degree of complexity of structure that you find in all societies, and these boundaries have to be put somewhere. Mm. And we just have to see that they're more or less in the appropriate places.
And I don't think they're weaker or stronger. The taboos we overthrow are the weak ones, but we're ruled by incredibly strong taboos. I was visited once in Hawaii by a bunch of Germans, and I took them down to the beach, and this woman immediately whipped her top off. And she knew that you can't do that in America, but she didn't believe it because it was so inconceivable to her. While I could not conceive of doing it any other way and realized that wave upon wave of social disruption would flow from this absurdly trivial act because a taboo had been violated that was just, one just doesn't do that. So we choose. Absolutely. Instantly. Public beach in Hawaii.
But the main thing is quite interesting one, because in traditional cultures, it's unknown that you call a person, it's very, very highly specified. And like, you know, in traditional Japan, there are whole characters and names from in the formal ones, and you gradually got down to less and less standard. And in England, you know, they're not inside, you call your husband so-and-so, and in India they do that. And, but nowadays, you know, even that got me to call it by the Christian name, or even the pet name, the pet name. So in those terms, the boundaries have got more and more flimsy, you know, between people.
Well, the boundaries move, that's right. But wherever they are sitting at any given moment, they are incredibly rigidly maintained against all reason. I mean, I remember when I lived in Benares, my houseboat was anchored near the bathing ghat, and you could watch 1,000 women wading into the Ganges, in soaking wet like rats. In their saris, you could watch 1,000 women bathing and never see a nipple or so much as a thigh, and it seemed perfectly reasonable to them to walk into the river fully clothed in order to preserve a sense of modesty. it did not seem to them silly, irrational, or preposterous. And yet, wasn't it? And isn't it absurd for Americans to keep, American women to keep their tops on at the beach? Yes, but it goes without saying. It's beyond question. And then the taboos that are negotiable change over time, but they usually don't address the central concerns of the society. I mean, for instance, this thing about topless beaches, all the beaches of France and Italy are topless, that means nothing in America. It will never change. I cannot conceive of it changing. The situation with cannabis is similar. Everyone knows that cannabis is trivial and harmless, but that doesn't mean that we're on the brink of changing the social taboos about it. It feels to me as though they will never change.
Those taboos are denial of the
sense of the sex. Yes, I agree. I think that one of the strongest divisions is the division between the sacred and the profane. They seem to be like oil and water. And once a profane domain is established, it will struggle with all of its resources to resist a re-sacralizing of that space. That's what has made Western civilization so toxic, is the fact that it is a continuous and spreading profanation, apparently to be carried on until the extinction of the planet, unless those few heretical voices that dare to oppose the imposition of this boundary are heard.
And so the significance of the Armenian problem is that, in fact, the problem is recharging which
really healthy. Well, so you're suggesting there are pathological taboos and taboos which actually maintain health.
Yeah.
I mean, the taboo about the hand that Rupert mentioned is probably a health-based taboo. You don't want to be transmitting amoebas to your friends or yourself.
Well, we don't want to eat poisonous plants. We don't want to eat...
But poisonous, it becomes a word. This is a word so fraught with cultural...
We're talking about Amanita Varna or something.
Well, your first shot of scotch, if this doesn't convince you that this is a toxic substance, but no, it turns out to be the basis of an entire culture, lifestyle, and philosophy. My rule when taking a shower in the Ganges, I would let my little bucket off the front of my houseboat, was it's pure if there's no turd larger than a thumb in it. So this is how India deals with the sacred river Ganges. This is where the bodies are being dumped, this is where the garbage is going. They don't seem to perceive any contradiction there. So why they should be so hoity-toity about taking a shower, it doesn't make any sense. They're not honoring the river by keeping themselves... They do honor the river, but these particular acts that we're discussing, I don't think are viewed as honoring the river. I don't know what the history of Indian prudence is. I suspected what I was seeing was Victorian ethos run mad.
Thank you. That's exactly what I meant at the beginning, where Jung psychoanalyzed God and found a fractal mixture of good and evil, and then of course we see it everywhere in nature. And the Ganges is not dirty water, it's actually a fractal mixture of excrement and clean water. And nature is a fractal, and the poisonous plants are growing intermixed with the food. So that's just the way of it, this planet. And when our societies are more like nature, maybe they have more longevity or
maybe not, and maybe the mathematical model helped to look at it, or maybe not. But in any case, we succeeded to draw back from the eschaton and the homing pigeons and somehow arrive in the society that we live in.
So the boundary is a rigidification of habit.
Yes, the boundary is a kind of a materialization of habit, I guess. And nature itself seems to have evolved. The structure came out of chaos in a process of creation in which order emerged and structure is made and matter materializes around habits and so on. In our personal life, in our family, in our school and institutions and so on, we have a lot of freedom, it seems, to behave this way or that, and within some realm we have choices, and that's why I think it's good to have a mathematical view of all this, because it does give you a way to extrapolate from nature, to make analogies between nature and the structures we're living in, and that's kind of diagnostic in itself. Mm. Maybe we should stop here. Do you think?
Sure. Yes. Feels like we've hit the moon boundary.
Since this has already been an overly long podcast, I'll refrain from any comments on the trilogue we just heard, other than to say that once again it seemed like it was Ralph Abraham who had to gallop in and save the day from some of Terence's more ungrounded speculations. But what great fun to listen to the three of these guys bounce such entertaining ideas off one another. And there still are a few more of these trilogue tapes to go. Today's conversation was the end of the Hazelwood House trilogues, but there are still others that they held that I haven't had a chance to podcast yet. So you can rest assured that over time you'll eventually hear the rest of them here in the salon too. Now, before I make a final comment, I want to mention, like I do every week, that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 2.5 license, which basically means you can use parts or all of this program if you want. Just go to the creativecommons.org site and you can read all about it. Or if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions about these podcasts, just send them to me, lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. And as a final note, I want to mention the passing of my friend Bud Wilkinson. Bud had just turned 91 years old shortly before he died, quite peacefully, I'm told, and with most of his children by his side. And while I realize that the chances are slim that you knew Bud, one of the reasons I want to mention him now is to point out how just being a nice person can help to make the world a little bit better for all of us. I only met Bud a couple of years ago when a mutual friend introduced us at the gym we both use several times a week. And the image of him shuffling into the gym each morning is still quite vivid for me, because the few moments I spent visiting with him on those mornings made going to the gym something that I actually looked forward to rather than dreaded. It was his smile that got you first, and I don't think I'll ever hear the word smile without first thinking of Bud. You know, he simply radiated vibrant energy and great joy. As it turned out, we figured that way back in the 50s, Bud had actually worked at some of the Chicago baseball games I attended as a boy. So we spent a lot of time talking about Chicago and, of course, Notre Dame football, which was one of his favorite topics. Like my own dad, Bud hadn't attended Notre Dame, but was part of the Subway alumni that the Chicago sports writers often talk about. Now, why am I spending all this time talking about an old man that I just casually spoke with at the gym? Well, first of all, it's because I miss him, and I want to thank him for his smile and for helping to make this world just a little easier for me to make my way through each day. And I guess that I wanted to point out to you that the next time you smile at a stranger, you just may be making someone's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day just a little more bearable. And besides, I'm told that it takes fewer muscles to smile than to frown. So, relax, be happy, and smile as often as you can. For now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.